I enjoy, I don't know about you, but I do, I kind of enjoy watching the political scene, the realm, political realm. I get on the news. I'm sort of a news junkie, if you want to call it that. In the mornings, I usually listen to Al Mohler on the way to work, and sometimes I'll get on his links and read the articles, et cetera, et cetera. But one thing I notice in the realm of politics, especially when in time of election year, is that the worst of people come out. You see it all around us. Those who maybe may have been colleagues and friends in the Senate, or maybe even governors, whatever it may be, they kind of turn on each other. And why do they turn on one another? They turn on one another because ultimately they're trying to get the one thing that they're all pursuing, which is what? Re-election. They want the office. They want power. And they will say things and do things and connive and use words and twist words and do all sorts of deceitful things in order to gain power. Am I right? I mean, that's what it appears. And we look at our culture, and our culture is really a reflection of our political pursuits, our political system. We are a people who want our way. That's why we side with certain people. I mean, this is, yeah, they speak to me because what? They represent who I am. And we look at this, and what happens in the political system is people become backbiting, they start arguing, they do all sorts of things in order to accomplish their purpose and their plans. Last week, what is interesting in this text, last week is that we looked at the blessings that God poured out on Isaac. We read that God allowed Isaac to grow in strength and stature. His crops produced 100-fold. His livestock and herds and servants increased more and more. God prospered and provided for Isaac so much so that the nations around him recognized that God was with him. But as we all know, no matter what blessings God bestows on his people, we seem to want more. More, more, more. That is the heart of everyone in this room. We are never, it seems like, content and satisfied with just God. We're not. In our text this morning, I am struck again by God's faithfulness and grace despite our continued failures, despite the fact that we continually want more. And in this text this morning, we see failure, we see sin, we see desire on all sides. And there are four main characters in the story. Four main characters: Esau, Jacob, Rebekah, and Isaac. These are the four characters, and each person in the story demonstrates his or her personal character flaws as they are trying to get what they want. You push a person hard enough, and you know what you find out? What they really are like. Take things away from them. Offer them certain things. Put them under the pressure of man and whether to be liked or disliked, and you begin to see what is really inside. It becomes apparent. And it becomes apparent in this text. The event central to the story is the covenant blessing of the next generation. And the question is, in this text, is this: who is going to receive the covenantal blessing? Will it be Esau or will it be Jacob? And you and I know the answer. We have heard this story before, but here's the key. The players in the story don't know the outcome. This is why narrative is so much fun, because if you get into the narrative, you realize it. You sit there and you go, wow, I know the outcome, but they don't know the outcome. They don't know what's going on. I was talking to a lady the other day at the hospital. She was reading this book, and I said, what are you reading? She tells me a little bit about it. She goes, but I don't like the book. I said, why are you reading? She goes, I just can't put it down. She goes, I've read it before, and I know the outcome, but every time I read it, and I'm reading the subject matter, I'm reading the people in the people in the story, I get so angry at one individual. I said, well, why do you keep reading it? Just put it down. You don't have to. He says, but I just love the story. I just love the story. I think as we come to this, we ought to recognize that the people, the characters in the story don't know what's transpiring. But we, as we read it, know. And we have the privilege that God has given us to see this played out. And God uses it in our lives so that we can see their flaws. So that we can learn from them. Here we see an entire family that fragments and divides over the pursuit of a blessing. Let me be clear this morning. Very clear. There is no one in this story to praise or to defend. There's not a single individual that you will hear me this morning say, there was a justification for that. As a matter of fact, every individual in the story is in many ways to be condemned in their attitude and in their actions. There is no justification for the deceit and manipulation that takes place. Brothers and sisters, hear me. There is no room in our lives for deceit or manipulation. Ever. If we find satisfaction in the Lord, there should never be in our hearts any room for deceit or manipulation to gain our will, to gain our wants. Rebecca and Jacob are co-conspirators in a grossly offensive ruse that fractures the family for decades and contributes to the disgrace of Jacob for all time. Jacob may have received the blessing, but Jacob is a disgraced man for the rest of his life. You may argue that Rebecca was concerned for God's will, but the fact of the matter is she used deception to accomplish her will. Hear me, ladies. Hear me very carefully. Manipulation and deception dishonor God. Period. And we are not even sure what her motive was. It could have been that she wanted the favorite son to succeed. We know that because we've already been informed in Genesis 25:28 that Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game. And then it says, but Rebecca loved Jacob. Already the lines have been drawn in this divided family. Isaac favors Esau, Rebecca favors Jacob. Isaac wants Esau to be the heir of the covenant blessing, although God has already said, what has God said? The older shall serve the younger. According to the text, Rebecca was told this. But it would be hard to believe that Rebecca didn't share this revelation with Isaac. Surely she would have informed Isaac of this surprising truth. But Isaac's affection was set on Esau. Despite Esau's wickedness and despite his sinfulness, Esau was bound and determined to give the blessing to his favorite son. Period. I hope you'll hear me this morning to say this, that in families, we see the sins played out so many times in our lifetime. Again and again. And this, in this story, we see how this plays out over the pursuit of the covenant blessing. And so what happens in the text, so you get an overview, I want you to see this. The story is broken up into six scenes. Six. We're only going to cover three this morning. Next week, we're going to do the final three scenes. But here's how the six of the scenes play out, okay? So you have Isaac's plan to bless Esau, which we find in Genesis 27:1-4. The second scene is Rebekah's plot with Jacob, and we find that in Genesis 27:5-17. The third scene we find is Jacob deceiving his father Isaac in 27:18-29. In the fourth scene, we see Isaac and Esau realizing the deception. In 5, the fifth scene, Rebekah warns Jacob. In the final scene, Isaac sends Jacob to his family. It's helpful to understand the sequence of events in order to see how dysfunctional and deceitful all of this is. And so we're going to look at these first three scenes, and we're going to ask the question, what can we learn from this story of deceit and disunity? Let's begin with how the story starts. It begins with these words. In chapter 26, verses 34 through 36, we read this. When Esau was 40 years old, he took Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, to be his wife. And Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. And they made life bitter for Isaac and Rebekah. These two verses frame the story of family tension. Esau demonstrates his disposition toward the covenant and the faith of his grandfather Abraham and his father by marrying two, not one, but marries two Canaanite women. He despises the covenant. He demonstrates this in two ways. First, he despises it by selling his birthright, and he sells it to Jacob for a bowl of stew. Second, he despises it by ignoring the warning of taking wives from surrounding pagan nations. There is a reason why Abraham sent his servant to get a wife for Isaac in his homeland. I'm going to tell you why. Abraham understood that the Canaanite women would not serve and worship the God of Abraham. That's the reality. And Abraham understood, look, if we're going to preserve the covenant, my sons need someone, i.e. a woman, to help them follow the Lord. Or at least worship the right God. Furthermore, Isaac, having experienced the bitter relationship of Esau's wives, says to Jacob in Genesis 28:1, here's what he says. This is huge, brothers and sisters. This is not should not be lost on us. He says this to Jacob. You must not take a wife from the Canaanite women. Why would he be so adamant about that? There may have been some beautiful, wonderful women who lived among the Canaanite nations, but he says, no. You go back. Why? Here's why. Because Laban and the rest of Abraham's family understood and knew the God of Abraham. That's why. No doubt, Isaac and Rebekah had seen this hardship in Esau's life. No doubt they had seen these women bring their form of culture and worship with them into the family, and this made life difficult in the family. There's application there. I didn't put it in my notes. But there is application because Paul talks about being unequally yoked in Corinthians. What does light have to do with fellowship? What would do with darkness? This fellowship with light and darkness? We are of the light. Why would we want to bind ourselves to darkness? Something to be said here about that. But more importantly, in the text, what is being communicated is that the covenantal promises are what they were to look to. And those covenantal promises were rooted in the God of Abraham. We also see something about the character and nature of Esau marrying these women. Esau is governed by his emotions. Hear this. Light. If you're governed by your emotions will govern you and you will make poor decisions. Esau is governed by his emotions. He is a man who is ruled by his fleshly desires. He marries not one, but two Canaanite women. The question becomes why. Was not one enough for his sensual desires? Later we find out that when Esau found out that his father was not pleased with these women, you know what he decided to do? He decided, I'm going to go marry a third one from his half-brother Ishmael's family. What is all of this about? Esau is concerned about Esau. Esau is not concerned about God. Esau is concerned about Esau. He represents a man who is ruled by his flesh. When he was hungry, he sold his birthright for what? Some stew and some bread? And when he wanted a wife, he's not satisfied finding a woman who would share the spiritual values of his family. Instead, he marries two pagan women to satisfy his sexual desires. Yes, I said that, and here's why. Because we are told, and we know this to be true based on Hebrews 12:16, and it warns us. Hebrews 12:16 says, don't be like Esau. It says this, see to it that no one is sexually immoral or unholy like Esau. That's what it tells us. Esau is a picture of a man who does everything by his emotions. What he feels like, he does. He loves women. He's going to get women. He loves food. It doesn't matter what it takes. I'm going to get the food. That is Esau's life. His actions betray his heart. And because his flesh governed his life, he forfeited God's blessings. Brothers and sisters, when God does not govern your heart will pursue worldly desires that will continue to draw you away from Jesus Christ. Esau is that example. He can have the worldly pleasures. He does have the worldly pleasures. But he forfeits the spiritual blessings of God. I know some of you just sitting here going, wait a minute, the promise. It's our Calvinistic tendency, right? Wait a minute, there's this tension here. You're not talking about what God had said would happen. That's exactly right, because I want you to hear something. Yes, I know what God has ordained and called to be. But upon Esau is the responsibility in which he ignores the responsibility and lives his life the way he chooses. He will never be able to lay the blame of God's sovereign decree upon his decision to do what he wanted to do. And none of us will, by the way. There will be no excuse before God and say, well, you just didn't choose me. No, God will say, I gave you the truth. What did you do with it? And that's the same thing with Esau. He knew what was to be true, and he did not pursue it. Now let's look at the three scenes and see what we can learn. So, verses 1 through 4, as I said earlier, this is the first scene in which Isaac is going to bless Esau. And here's what we learn from this. I'm going to give you it now so you know what number 1 is. Here's what we'll see from verses 1 through 4. When we ignore God's will, here's number 1. When we ignore God's will, we set ourselves up for failure and difficulties. In scene 1, we read that Isaac called his son Esau to him, and he said to him, behold, I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now then, take your weapons, your quiver, and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me. Hoo-yah. You know, that's manly there. And prepare for me delicious food such as I love. Don't miss that statement. It's a clue. And bring it to me so that I may eat, that my soul may bless you before I die. At this point, Isaac is at least 100 years old because we're told in verse 34 that Esau was 40 when he took his wives. Luther calculates that he was probably 137, which means he's going to live. Isaac is going to live at least another 40 years because he dies at 180. But at this point, Isaac believes he may die and he wants to bless his son. But what is significant is what Isaac requests. He asks Esau to hunt game for him and make him a quote-unquote delicious meal before he dies. And what I find interesting is that Isaac is seeking to satisfy his own appetite before he gives Esau his blessing. Why does the author record for us Isaac's desire for a good meal? Brothers and sisters, think with me. Why does it matter what he wants before he blesses Esau? There's a connection. The Holy Spirit is making a connection. What we see with Isaac is this own struggle with his own appetite, his fleshly desire. I mean, I don't think that this is put in here so that Jacob and Rebekah can have plenty of time to manipulate a plan. I think the author is making the connection between Isaac's appetite and Esau's appetite that he was willing to satisfy for the promise of his birthright. James Boyce says, Isaac's taste for wild game at least partly accounts for his love for Esau, and here he simply wants to indulge his physical appetite before giving his blessing. This base appetite had been passed on to Esau. Remember when we talked about the sins of the fathers? The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. It never does, brothers and sisters. It never does. This base appetite that had been passed on to Esau because earlier Esau had sold his birthright to Jacob for a bowl of stew. I think we see here some of Isaac's own character flaws. He allowed his pleasure in eating of Esau's game to distract him from the reality of his son's failures and wickedness. I just want to challenge you this morning. I really do. We're a small church. We've got a lot of children. And we are responsible for raising our children to the best of our abilities so that they see the glory of God in Christ in our lives. But how many in this room have a tendency to favor certain children and to look over their failures because what? They are the one that we love. How many parents do you know who will excuse their children's actions when they're pointed out by somebody else? Because why? Because the parent loves them. These children in here are still very young, but as they grow up, moms and dads, if you don't begin to see the sin and the character flaws in your children's life and address them, those will stay with them the rest of their lives and it could lead to their destruction. That's a reality. The very sins in your life which you struggle with, and you know, you ought to communicate them to your children so that they're aware of them. Your son should not be surprised that you as a father may struggle with lust. Why? It's a common reality for all men. Your son shouldn't come to that knowledge on his own after the fact that he's realized, shoot, I've ruined my life. Look what decisions I've made. All based on his fleshly desires. And the fact that he spends hours without ever telling his father that he's in front of the computer looking at pornography, knowing that the father all along struggled with that and never said a word to his son. Esau was in some way, shape, or form bound to his own fleshly appetites. And the text makes that clear. And we see it. And yet, Esau is not said, Isaac, excuse me, says nothing. More importantly, what we see in Isaac's total disregard for the will of God, this is the most important thing. Isaac's total disregard for the will of God. Isaac knew the prophecy, the older shall serve the younger. Already, Esau has sold his birthright to Jacob. And by the way, birthright and blessing are not the same. Birthright pertains to the inheritance of the father's possessions. Jacob now will receive the bulk of the inheritance that Isaac was willing to forfeit. Blessings refer to what the individual will obtain in life. It was the father's prerogative to determine how he would bless, who he would bless and how. He would even bestow a curse if necessary. Isaac knew the significance of the blessing. As we are going to see, his blessing was such that it could not be withdrawn, which leads ultimately with Esau with nothing. But Isaac also knew that Jacob would have been the recipient of the blessing. Not only had God's will been made known, but Esau had demonstrated his indifference and even his hostility to the covenant. Yet Isaac disregarded all of these things because he favored Esau. And by doing so, he set himself up and his family for greater pain and division. Fathers, you know the will of the Lord. You know it in our context under the new covenant that we are to be what? Pursuing Christ with all of our heart, soul, strength, and mind. Are you communicating to your children that that is the will of God for their lives as well? I wonder if Isaac was passive in his role as a father. Esau, he's going to do what he's going to do. He's a hunter. He's a man's man. I got nothing to worry about. He likes to be out in the fields. He can kill game. He can make a living. He can support himself. Jacob, he's a mama's boy. And instead of rebuking and disciplining Esau as a boy and a young man, he allowed Esau to go his own way, not wanting to interfere with his favorite son. Now Esau was grown with his own family and the opportunity for Isaac's influence was gone. Yet Isaac continued to favor his eldest son, ignoring the reality that Isaac would never, never, never be the one to hold fast to the covenant of God. But he wasn't going to let go, come hell or high water. Esau was his boy. Brothers and sisters, when you ignore God's will and choose to follow your own desire despite God's truth, you set yourself up for failure and greater difficulties. When you place your children, your spouse, your dreams, your hopes above what God desires, you will find that there is no peace, there is no joy, and there is no contentment in your life. It's a reality. If you set up your dreams to include not pursuing Christ, but pursuing what your family and your children and your spouse and whatever dreams that you have, those are set on the pedestal before God, you will find no peace. There will only be heartache and there will only be disappointment. Number two, second scene. In this second scene, we see the setup of deception. There's Rebecca as she comes in to dishonor Esau, but more importantly, dishonor God. Here's number two. Here's the number two point. Here's what I put in for number two. What can we learn from this? When we use deception and manipulation to accomplish our own purposes, God is dishonored. Say it again. When we use deception and manipulation to accomplish our own purposes, God is dishonored. In scene two, Rebecca hears what Isaac is planning to do and sets up her own plan to steal the blessing for Jacob. Why? Her favorite son. She plans this elaborate scheme to have Isaac believe that he is blessing Jacob. And she is going to use it. She's going to do this using Isaac's own weaknesses, not his blindness, brothers and sisters. She's using his very weakness, and the weakness is what? His appetite. She prepares the meal, this delicious meal. She also covers Jacob with animal skins in order to give Jacob the hairy feeling of Esau. None of this is without risk. Jacob is rightly concerned when he says to her, "Perhaps my father will feel me and I shall seem to be mocking him and bring a curse upon myself and not a blessing." And what does she say to Jacob? "Let your curse be on me, my son. Only obey my voice and go, bring them to me." Twice she says this. Again, none, hear me, please hear me. None of what Rebecca is doing is excusable. Some commentators have argued that Rebecca's actions were virtuous. Chrysostom commented approvingly of Rebecca's action as a mother's affection, or rather God's design. Calvin praised her faith, for she volunteers to intercept the wrath of her husband should her plot fail. I disagree. So I disagree with Calvin and Chrysostom. So, the reality is this. She is being deceitful. Her actions, everything that she does is deceptive and manipulative despite what God had prophesied. The irony in all of this is that the very son she is trying to have blessed, and because she favors him, she ends up losing because of Esau's death threats. That's the irony behind all of this. The very son she once blessed, she loses. Because she has to tell him to get out of here, you're going to get killed. And she never sees him again. Notice what's going on in this household. No one trusts anyone. No one. Rebekah doesn't trust Isaac, nor Isaac Rebekah. Jacob knew his father wouldn't trust him. And Esau doesn't trust Jacob. But what's Rebekah's real failure? She doesn't trust God. She doesn't trust God to keep his promise. Rebekah had to take things into her own hands. That's what she felt. And by doing so, she showed her own unbelief in the promises of God. She usurped her husband's authority and showed her son an ungodly example of manipulation. And guess what? It's not an accident that Jacob becomes the trickster. Why would Jacob become the trickster? He's watched his mom again and again and again. His mom has this proclivity of, let's not say anything. Keep it between us. There is nothing to commend Rebekah for, even if Jacob receives the blessing. As Boyce has said, having done it her way, good did not come. You heard me say it right. Having it her way, good did not come. True, the blessings went to Jacob, which God would have arranged anyway. But the price was 20 years of unexpected exile for Jacob, exile for which he had not been prepared by his sheltered life at home. And can I say something? Jacob never got the inheritance as the firstborn. You know what it ended up going to? It all went to Esau anyway. You know why? Because Jacob left the household with nothing. And remember when Jacob is coming back after the 14 years of trying to be himself being tricked? By the way, that's my title when we get there. The trickster is tricked. That's the title. And what happens when he comes 14 years later? Esau has his own household and has all the goods, and he's terrified. He lives in fear. The question we might ask is, what if Rebekah had not intervened? What would have happened to God's promise? Can I just say this? God would have accomplished his purposes without her intervention. You know why? Because God is going to keep his word. God is going to do what he wills with Jacob or Esau. Why couldn't she have left it in her hand, or God's hands, instead of taking it in her own hands? How many times do you take things into your own hands, brothers and sisters? It's not working out the way we want. So what do we have to do? We have to connive and manipulate so we can get what we want. It happens in the workplace all the time. And it can also happen in the home. There are no answers as to what God would have done had she not intervened. But it was God's promise, not Rebekah's. Period. Unfortunately, Rebekah took it upon herself to accomplish what ultimately belonged to God. Instead of waiting, instead of trusting, she had to intervene. Ultimately, it dishonored God because she acted in unbelief through her deception and manipulation. Brothers and sisters, you may try to manipulate your world to achieve your success or blessings. Hear me. And you may actually succeed in achieving those physical blessings. But in doing what you do, you will be acting out of unbelief and you will dishonor your Lord and your God. God may even achieve your end result. Or you may even achieve your end result. But in the end, you may lose more than you ever anticipated. If you want to achieve your end result, and you might, you may end up losing far more than you ever anticipated, despite what you were trying to accomplish. As far as we know, Rebecca never saw Jacob again. Her favorite son. Oh, she got him the blessing. He had to leave for good. Are our desires, let me ask you a question, are our desires worth dishonoring the name of God? Last scene, third scene. We'll pick it up again next week with the next three scenes, but I wanted to see this last scene quickly. And I know it's the longest section, and I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on it, but here's what I would say to this scene. Here's what we can learn from it. Here it is. Just because we achieve what we want through manipulation and deceit, just because we achieve what we want through manipulation and deceit, God never condones it. No matter what, you say, well, the ends justify the means. No, they don't, ever. Not when it's our pursuit of our desires and our passion. In scene three, we move to the center of the story. This is at the heart of the story. Jacob deceived his father and received the blessing. God accomplished his purpose despite, huge, despite the failures and sins of Isaac and Rebekah. And there will be consequences. Always. Jacob demonstrates his productivity for deception. He plays the part well and deceives his father. And though he gets the blessing, God never condones the means. One commentator writes, Rebekah and Jacob gained nothing, and they lost a great deal by their wicked interference. They gained nothing. For God had promised that the birthright would be Jacob's and would have given it to him in some way, redounding to his credit and not to his shame. And they lost a great deal. The mother lost her son. Jacob had to flee for his life, and for all we know, Rebekah never saw him more. And Jacob lost all the comforts of home and all those possessions his father had accumulated. He had to flee with nothing but his staff, an outcast to begin the world for himself. From this first false step towards onwards to his death, he was pursued by misfortune until his own verdict on his life was this. This was his statement to Pharaoh. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life. Because he chose to do it his way. What does that apply to? It applies to every aspect of our lives. It applies to our families. It applies to our jobs. It applies to our relationships. It applies to the church. It applies to every category. When we seek to do things our way and not God's way, you can be sure that there will be consequences. You say, well, where's the gospel in all of that? Right? Where's the gospel in this? Just thinking through that, and I thought, you know what? There's all kinds of gospel in here. Here's the gospel, brothers and sisters. The gospel is, despite the fact that we sometimes and have used deceit and manipulation to achieve our own success, God continues to be gracious and merciful to us. You know what? Jacob was a deceitful man. God took the trickster and used him as the father of 12 tribes. That's incredible to me. In other words, I'm not in any way, shape, or form justifying any of this that happened. I've tried to make it clear this morning that it doesn't, that the ends never justify the means. What they did was wrong, it was sinful, it was wicked. And yet, God, in His grace and His mercy, uses people like Jacob, like me, and like you to glorify His name. That's the gospel. Because if you don't see Jacob in you, then you don't see yourself for what you really are. Because I see Jacob in me. Every one of us in this room have a tendency to twist truth for our own sake. We have a tendency to make things better for our own good. We have a tendency of seeing ourselves far better than what we really are. And the reality is that every single one of us in here has a heart that is deceptive. A heart that pursues its own idolatrous treasures in this world. And despite those things, God continues to be faithful and gracious to us. That's the gospel. Because what God is going to do is He's going to take Jacob the trickster and He's going to transform his life. And He's going to teach Jacob a few of his own lessons by himself being tricked. So that Jacob comes to understand that all that he is and all that he has was not because of what Jacob did, but because of what God was doing for him when he never saw any of it. That's the gospel. That's the gospel. The gospel is here, brothers and sisters. And you may not like to hear it. You know what? Unless you see your sin and your condition, you can't see your grace. Yesterday, we spent time at the marriage conference over at Cornerstone Church. There was a lot about grace, a lot about grace. And it was wonderful. I was so blessed by the conference as Ray Ortland spoke and his wife Janie. But I was talking to my wife. I said, one thing I miss there is to see how sinful we really are. Our hearts are prone to deceit. Ray made one comment that was great. He says, when I see the lust of my flesh and realize my sexual lust that creep up and I say, yep, there I go again, it makes me long for heaven all the more. I want to be free of this deceit. I want to be free of these earthly passions that cause me to wander away from my Lord and my God. I want to be free from pride and anger and selfishness. I want God to be glorified in my life. I don't want to follow in the steps of Rebecca and Jacob. I don't want to follow the steps of Isaac and be bound to my appetite. I don't want to be like Esau and ignore the covenant blessings of God. I don't want to be like these people. You know what I mean by that, right? I want to be one that is pursuing Christ. Have the world. Take the world, but give me Jesus. That should be our desire. Have the world. You can have the world. Just give me Jesus. That's why I think that when we sing, all I have is Christ, that should be our cry. All I have is Christ. Brothers and sisters, if your heart is not content with God and God alone and His plans and purposes in your life, you will end up with so many disappointments. Life will be one disappointment after another unless God is your treasure. The reason this takes place in this text is because God was not treasured in this family. That's exactly why. God was not treasured. And unless God's treasured in our hearts, we too will do what our heart is set on.